Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and I'm at the Arts Theatre in central London today to talk to the playwright Richard Verjet, whose latest play, the award-winning American Justice, is currently on at this venue. Richard has worked as a drama teacher in Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and he is co-founder with Andrew Pearson of Ensemble 52 Theatre Company. His other plays include An Englishman's Home, Harry's Luck, and the forthcoming Gibraltar. So, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thanks very much.
Could you start off by talking a bit about how American Justice began?
Yeah.
Apparently it had a different
It did have a different original title, As We Forgive Them. And when I started work with Lisa Farrell, she said, for God's sake, we've got to change that title because nobody can remember it. And she started to call it As We Forget Them.
She's the director.
She's
of
the
this
director.
Production.
So, yeah. So we sort of had some discussions about that. It began as an entry to a new writing festival in Manchester, called the 24/7 Theatre Festival. A festival that's been going, I think it's now in its 10th year, and it was a festival set up by a guy called David Slack specifically to promote new work, but give it a chance to be put on, not just to sort of to win a competition, but actually if it were accepted into a festival, that it's produced, and then you then decide what to do with it from there. So I entered this script. I remember distinctly when I started writing it. I was doing pantomime in Rotherham, I'm not really enjoying myself. And I don't know. I started sort of writing. I had this idea in the back of my head, and I started tapping it out in the dressing room, you know. And entered it for this new writing festival. It was selected, and we produced it in Manchester in July 2009. And in those days, it was a two-hander. It was and 1 hour long. It was very, very
compact.
Very compact. I mean, in order to put it on, I bought a flip chart. I nicked a desk from my wife's school and borrowed a couple of plastic chairs from a mate of mine who's got a catering company. And that was the set. And then I bought an orange boiler suit from eBay and a briefcase. And that was it, you know. And so we put this thing on in Manchester, and it did well, and then it's sort of gone on from there.
Yeah. You were in it yourself at some point.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, at the time that I was writing it, I'd been a full-time teacher up until 2005. Then I was doing a fair amount of consultative and my own work as an education kind of advisor. But I was also acting professionally. Yeah. And I was with An Englishman's Home and with this, I was sort of providing myself with opportunities. That's the way that I saw it, you know. If you can't get a meaty role, write one. That was part of the sense behind it.
So whose idea was it to develop this into a full length?
Well, we did well with it at the 24/7. Mm. And we then had the opportunity of performing it at the Octagon in Bolton, at the Bill Norton Studio. And then down here at the Clare Studio at the Young Vic.
Oh, yeah.
And because we'd done quite well with it, and because people's response to it was very positive, we thought, well, maybe we should stick with this and do a little bit more. And when I say we, I'm talking about, you know, Andrew Pearson and myself at Ensemble 52. So at that point, I expanded it a little bit so that it became a 75, 80-minute piece. And we put it on at Salford. We got some Arts Council funding, put it on at the brewery in the tobacco factory rather in Bristol, and then we were the first play to be on in the second studio at the Arcola in January 2011.
All right.
So that was sort of as far as we took it.
Yeah.
But Gabby Vautier, who was working at the Young Vic at the time that it came there, felt that she wanted to do more with it, and she really has championed the piece over the last couple of years. Put me in touch with Lisa, and we had, you know, discussions about the idea of a third character, who that third character would be. I was unsure to begin with. I felt that it worked as a kind of a two-person dialectic in the room. But by introducing the third character, that really, in a sense, opened up the context of where they were. And the context of the prison, and in a way lent credence to the new title of American Justice.
I think we'd better give a short précis of the plot. Do you mind saying it's set in a penitentiary in the south?
It is.
In a southern state of America.
That's right, yeah. It is. It was written, and I think it's sort of important to say when it was written. The first version, As We Forgive Them, was written immediately after Obama's victory.
All right.
When the sound of his rhetoric was still fresh in my ears and in everybody else's as well.
Absolutely.
And some of us were beginning to kind of try to interrogate what it was we could do.
Yeah.
And what, you know, yes, we can, and precisely what audacious hopes there were. And how they were going to be made manifest.
And in fact, you quote that.
Yeah, I do.
In the play.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. So the first version of it was written then. It is about a liberal, Democrat congressman who is elected at the same time as Obama as part of that wave of optimism and idealism.
And he's Daniels.
And he is John Daniels.
Yeah.
But his life at the moment that his life is complete. He is struck by tragedy because his daughter is murdered by what we've described in the publicity, I suppose, as a feral thug, basically, you know, in a sort of dirty street crime.
Yeah.
In an apparent gesture of forgiveness, he requests that this offender, this murderer, be reprieved from death row, reprieved from capital punishment, on the strict understanding that he be allowed to educate him. And the course of the play shows his education of Fenton, the prisoner, across the three time zones of the play, which are all in the aftermath of presidential elections, 2008, 2012, 2016.
Now, why did you do that schema? Because 2016 obviously is the future. Was it to
when I first wrote it, 2012 was the future. There was no guarantee that Obama was going to be re-elected. In the first draft, I had Obama being re-elected and also winning the Nobel Peace Prize. And Andrew Pearson said, no, cut out the bit about the Nobel Peace Prize. It's just going to look like an Obama love it. And of course, the bugger won it.
Yeah.
You know, and I could have been hailed as a visionary. You know, but instead, I cut that bit out. Anyway, so it was all in the future. It was all in the future. And part of the reason for doing that was originally, when I first had the idea, I was going to set it in 1992 to 2000. Yeah. But then, with the Obama victory, I thought, no, I've got to tap into this somehow.
Yeah,
and I've got to project what might happen to this.
Yeah.
I'm also writing it at a time of the dying embers of the Labour administration in this country. And a feeling, as quite a number of us did, I'm sure, of precisely what is there to show for over a decade's Labour administration. Yeah. I'm not saying there was nothing, but for many of us there wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, I kind of wanted to project the play as something of a warning of inaction.
Right.
So it wasn't, as I think some people have said, my cynicism about liberal politics. But it is, in a sense, a kind of a warning that these things, that this rhetoric, this sounds of promise and wonderful ideology, if it's not kind of anchored to firm policy and commitment, can just stay as so much hot air.
Right. And why did you choose to look at the American justice system?
It's a bit cheeky, isn't it, for a Brit to do that, really?
Well,
I think a couple of reasons, really. First of all, because there was that lever of the death penalty that added an edge to the piece. Also, I think that there is so much of the American justice system which permeates itself into our culture, whether it be, you know, things like Judge Judy, which is to sort of some extent a sideline. But we have been aware, I think, in this country, as well as in the States, of certain kind of cases that have that have been news in this country. I'm going back a few years. But you will probably be aware of the case of Matthew Shepard, which was then made into a play called The Laramie Project.
Yeah.
And of that, of the father's famous speech at the trial of his son's murder. Matthew Shepard is a young gay man who is picked up in a bar. He's murdered. He's left for dead in the fields of Wyoming. And at the trial of his murderers, the parents are given the option of implementing the death penalty or not. And they choose not to.
Yeah.
And the father says to his son's murderer, "May you have a long life, and may you thank my son every day for it." And that kind of resonated with me. And I used to do some work around the Laramie Project when I was teaching at John Leggett at the sixth form college where I worked. And I suppose that was one of the sources of inspiration. I also remember the kind of the extraordinary trial, and I'm going back really quite a few years now, with Louise Woodward, the nanny, who was convicted for murdering, in the end it was commuted to manslaughter, Matthew Epen. And it struck me that in a way that American trials are great theatre in that, you know, people make these speeches about God and redemption and grandma and all the rest. I'm not wishing to sort of belittle an individual's grief, but in a way where our own are quite sort of stoical by their very nature, the Americans are sort of quite dramatic. And I felt, well, this is a culture that I can tap into. Take that, you know, with the Obama rhetoric. I just felt that was some great ingredients for some pretty potent drama.
And the character of John Daniels, it turns out that his motives are not as pure. No. His desire to educate Lee is a desire, really, for him to understand his own guilt better and to suffer more, because originally he's quite a feral youth. Now he's much more aware and educated. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. As a teacher, I've sometimes found that students who have been the most able, if you will, the most aware, are not necessarily the happiest. I remember very distinctly many years ago as a tutor at the sixth form college, and it was somebody who I didn't teach, but I was her personal tutor. And she was a very bright girl, and she was destined for to do very, very well, and had places at university and so forth, top universities and so forth. And she came to me one day in floods of tears and sort of, you know, said, "Well, what on earth's the matter?" And this girl sort of saying, well, what's it all for? I said, "Well, what do you mean what it's all for?" She said, I'm working like hell. She said, I'm getting these, you know, I'm predicting these grades. She said, but what's it? I said, well, it gives you choices, it gives you options, you know, you're going to be able to get to university. It's there's so much evidence that people who go through university have better life chances and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, she said, but I look at my dad and he did all of that and he just looks old and tired. And that kind of almost, I wasn't quite sure what to say to that. Yeah. Because you can't sort of take the party line about, well, work hard and go to university and get a good job and all of that, when somebody has kind of seen through it. And it's almost kind of seeing through the great myth of success. So how the hell do you sell it then? So I was partly aware that that some of my brighter students were not. Sometimes the brightness brought them disillusionment. Sadly, not always. But there's also that great line in Jim Cartwright's Road when the character of Joey curses God for giving him an awareness of seeing how terrible his life is. Yes. And that was a piece that sort of resonated with me as well. Because, you know, again, it was a piece that I used to work on with my students. So it was partly that idea that education can be used, or the potential for it to be used, in a kind of negative way, when somebody is given all these options, but then nowhere to use those options because he's incarcerated.
Yeah.
So that, to me, seemed almost like a perfect storm of revenge in a way.
The character of Lee, the murderer, can you talk a bit about him? Because at the beginning of the play, he's quite desperate, and it seems to be a hopeless mission to educate him.
Absolutely. I think that, again, you know, as a teacher, I'm aware of so many people that slip through the net for one reason and another, usually to do with background, with social class and so forth.
Poverty, really.
Poverty, absolutely. And the short-sightedness, which is only picked up by Daniels at the end of that first scene, that has caused quite a lot. You know, some people have, again, being quite cross about that, said that is utterly inconceivable. Roger Grafe, the criminologist, came and said that for him that was the best moment of the play.
Yeah.
Because he said that that was, you know...
Why should it be incredible?
I don't know. But, yeah. but, you know, it's the idea that some people couldn't accept that he could slip through the net so easily. Mm. You know, he's short-sighted, he's disruptive. Sit at the back so he can't see. Yeah. Nobody at home is teaching him how to read. Mm. And he is sort of quite an example of somebody who the system has utterly and completely failed. I also am fairly firmly of the view that that we are all that to a lesser or greater extent we are all educable. One of my kids is disabled; he has Down syndrome. He has a reading age of 7.5, and he did so at the age of 11. Now, if he'd been born when I was born, he would have probably been deemed to be ineducable.
Yeah.
And he would never have been given the opportunities that have been given. And whilst, you know, obviously, he is probably never going to live a fully independent life, the fact remains that he is that he is educable. And I kind of wanted to show that through Lee. I didn't want Lee to be a genius. I think, you know, some people sort of tried to say that, that you know, in the second scene, oh, there he is a model student and he becomes a graduate of literature. Actually, the final scene, he passes his high school graduation.
Yeah.
He's a reasonably bright young man.
Yeah.
As most,
but he isn't, he's a PhD student.
No.
He's never going to be an intellectual.
Of course. No, he's not an intellectual. No, he's not. Yeah. No, Daniels is an academic.
Yeah.
And Lee isn't an academic.
No.
But I mean, but he has a kind of an innate brightness.
Yeah.
Which comes through in a couple
of shades of educating Rita.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can. I suppose so. But I mean, yes, I suppose it is.
Yeah.
And there are one or two, and just as Rita kind of comes through the cant, I suppose, with a number of very pertinent statements.
Exactly.
Lee does in a way as well. You know, talking about John F. Kennedy, well, who but an idiot would drive through Dallas with the top down? Absolutely. Who but an idiot would?
Yeah.
You know, he's absolutely right. You know.
Yeah. Right. Now, Lee is a white guy, and I just wondered, given the sort of history of capital punishment so on in the United States, why you didn't specify that he's black, or is it flexible
it
enough?
It is flexible. It's flexible. When we first did As We Forgive Them, and we held auditions, a black guy auditioned, and he very nearly got the role.
Okay.
We went with a guy called Joe Sims, who played the role all the way through until we were at the Arcola, and played it brilliantly as well. But no, it is flexible.
Good, yeah.
And of course, that would lend, because you know, somebody said, well, if you have a black guy in that role, when he calls Daniels a nigger lover, what would you do about that? So keep it in.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Keep it in,
totally. Yeah. The politics of the play, it's about redemption, but at the same time there's this image of that famous Jimmy Stewart film, It's a Wonderful Life, where it does assert the possibility of change, but that is also questioned very vigorously. What are the politics of the play, do you think?
Well, I mean, the politics of the play are unashamedly left of centre. And the fact that you see at the centre of it a liberal politician who may be ineffectual should not give succour to the right, you know, to the right wing. It is putting across the idea that change is undoubtedly possible. What I think we had in this country in the late 90s and in the early part of the 21st century was a government who never quite believed that they'd been elected. They never quite believed that they'd got the mandate that they had to change things in the way that they could have done. If you look at the Thatcher government and that great period of reforming with the privatisation, that happened in the second term. What was Blair doing in the second term? He was trying to gain international credibility by invading Iraq.
Yeah.
And of course, by the time he's working on the things in education that I worked on during the third term, it's too bloody late.
Yeah.
You get a monster like Gove, he can reverse everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it was not embedded enough soon enough. Mm. And change is undoubtedly possible. I also think, you know, Michael Billington said that there is a sort of self-flagellating quality about the play, which I thought was quite funny, you know, in the way that we sort of attack the liberalism, or we attack Daniel's politics. I'm not attacking his politics. I'd probably vote for him because I think that he is a man of conviction.
Yeah. And certainly better than the alternative.
And certainly a hell of a lot better than the alternative. But I think that sometimes if we lose ourselves in the rhetoric of victory, and I think that that was what was happening at the end of 2008, and to some extent in 1997 as well in this country, you then don't anchor that optimism to real change. Mm. So the play is saying real change is possible. Real change is embodied in Lee Fenton. Mm.
Yeah.
He exemplifies real change. He exemplifies what an individual like Daniels can do when he puts his mind to something. So there is actually... The play's message is not a pessimistic one, I would suggest. We don't know, and I've never sort of wanted to kind of commit to this, we don't know how successful Daniels has been as a politician.
Yeah.
I suspect rather better than he thinks that he is.
Yeah.
I suspect that Daniels is probably his own worst critic.
Why did you decide to adopt a thriller format? Because it's a kind of psychological thriller, and there's one or two really intense and intensely enjoyable twists at the end.
Well, I think, to be honest, you know, whenever you write a play, somebody will always kind of challenge you and sort of say, well, who is this for? Who is your target audience? Mm. And I've always struggled with that question. And the only honest answer I can ever give to that is me.
Yeah.
It's for me. Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that I would like to see. And I have to say that, you know, I find those moments dramatically satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I don't think, at least I hope not, that the thriller format dilutes the content of the play. I think, you know, sometimes that has been perhaps suggested that, the twists are too neat or they're too contrived or whatever. I don't think so. I mean, it's provided those twists are organic to your material and organic to your characters and not sort of grafted on, then why not? I mean, I love hearing those gasps.
Yeah.
In the audience. And you do, you know, you hear those gasps in the audience when Daniels turns on him.
Yeah.
And says, you can rot. I mean, that kind of, how can he do that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and
well,
it's
also a symbolic drama. It's not just a naturalistic story.
No,
otherwise, you would tell a much more depressing story of somebody just waiting for their execution, really.
You
need that level of heightened realism.
Yes, of
otherwise, there's nothing to talk about.
Not really.
Because most people are. Well, most people who go to the theatre are against the death penalty.
There wouldn't be
much of a drama.
That's right, yes. I mean, all you end up doing is sort of a rather elaborate exercise in preaching to the converted.
Yeah, or it would be just about redemption, which just by itself is, you know...
And some people kind of feel a bit cheated. Actually, I have to say, there are one or two people who feel cheated that it isn't just about redemption.
Hmm.
They kind of want the... You know, they feel that sort of when he turns on him, it is a bit too contrived. However, most people can kind of see the dramatic satisfaction in that, but they also kind of see as well the flaw in it. From it's quite an important twist because Daniels is educating with the belief that he is turning Lee into a different kind of human being. And I think that when you look at education policy and the way that politicians try to control education and do control education, and they control the content of education, they control the delivery sometimes of education, they have it very clearly in their minds what the end product should be. I think, was it Blair who talked about, you know, an educated workforce?
Mm.
I find that phrase quite chilling as an educator. And it's that idea of, I will educate this man in this way because I will be able to control the outcome of it. And in the end, the whole point of Lee turning around and doing what he does is to say, fuck you, no, you can't.
Yes.
You can't control it.
And there's
a
brilliant phrase about, if you want to play mind games, well, here's a good one.
Absolutely,
and
you've got yourself
the whole story upside
down right at the end.
That's
right,
You talked about audience reactions. How do audiences react in your experience?
They have a kind of, particularly in that last, they go along with it. They are charmed by it. They enjoy the apparent closeness, the gradually getting closer of these two guys, and the discussions afterwards are quite animated. And the responses to it are not indifferent, shall we say. You know, people come out talking about it. One of the things that we've been able to do with the outreach part of this production is that Gabby, as a producer, has been sort of instrumental in getting in audiences from recent offenders and young offenders and people sort of who've fallen the wrong side of the criminal justice system. And they have responded to it very positively. I brought a group of kids from school down on Saturday. They loved it. They thought it was terrific. They do sort of enjoy the ending, and they do sort of enjoy the twists. So it's gone down pretty well. And then there are a few people who have got really cross about it.
Are they cross about?
That's well, I think
I can't quite.
If you look at the reviews as a whole, yeah. I mean, we go from sort of one extreme to another. I mean, we've gone from taut psychological thriller, brilliantly told, very, very positive, to sort of one-star reviews where we've been sort of eviscerated for being cliched, contrived. I'm manipulating the characters in order to get that kind of, desperate to get a response out of the audience. I manipulate the characters. So people feel in a way that I've been, some people feel that I've sort of manipulated that kind of response. Interestingly, I mean, I'm not trying to be sort of politico-paranoid about this. Of we've had three quite nasty reviews. Yeah. Two of them have come from right-wing newspapers. Whether that's me being, I don't know. I don't know. But some people, I think, sort of almost feel that the ending is perhaps too interventionist on my part, that I've somehow manipulated a response.
Well, you are the playwright. Well, you are the creator of the story.
But I swear to you, it is all consistent with the characters and their motives. But for the most part, people like it. People are engaged by it. People are excited by it. And the fact that it's all over pretty quickly, leaves them fairly breathless.
Yeah.
So we've had some great responses.
Yeah. Because as well as being about sort of the penal system and about punishment and about redemption and about revenge, it is also about the media. There's a scene when they prepare for a press conference.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that gave me the impression, once again, how heightened, both in the United States and in this country, because I do think this has resonance for people living here, how heightened the rhetoric about crime can be.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, you've only to sort of... the whole... fiasco of these recent, police commissioner elections, and all of this kind of subsequent hype about, I was getting sort of leaflets through the door from, my first job as police commissioner will be to reduce crime. Well, pretty much your only job, isn't it? What the hell else are you doing? what else? And the way that people will sort of use crime as a political platform, much as they use education as a political platform, to kind of grandstand and to make gestures and so forth without actually necessarily trying to change things. Now, I think Daniel's actually almost inadvertently, having set himself on this course of action, finds himself in a position where he really does change things, by implementing this policy, the idea of educating prisoners. A great play about education and internment is Our Country's Good, which again was a source of inspiration, very much so. That you can, you can change things. It isn't necessarily about grandstanding, but far too often it is.
Yeah, great. That's a nice place to end it. Thank you very much, Richard.